You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Thursday, February 25th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the Manhattan DA, as of about an hour ago, has Donald Trump's taxes. Meanwhile, the military begins vaccination deliveries in New York and Texas, soon in Florida and Pennsylvania, as the real-world performance of the Pfizer vaccine after two doses is 95% protection for hospitalization and serious illness. The House to pass a COVID relief bill tomorrow. Progressives warn Senate Democrats about the minimum wage. Meanwhile, the bill has enormous popular support, even amongst Republicans. Will Joe Biden give Louis DeJoy the boot? Well, yesterday in front of Congress, the postmaster tells the House, get used to me. Meanwhile, an ex-Cuomo aide alleges a ongoing sexual harassment by the governor. The White House claims it's going to fight for Neera Tanden's nomination, but it doesn't appear anybody else will. Joe Biden getting mixed marks on immigration front. New report, not only did Texans' energy deregulation leave Texans unprotected, it cost them more. The U.S. government will release a declassified report today, which will single out Saudi prince for the Khashoggi killing. Senate is bucking Nancy Pelosi's January 6th commission. And some sad news for New York, Seattle, and Portland. Joe Biden has revoked Donald Trump's order. You are no longer anarchist cities. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
You seem to be a little bit out of sorts.
I dropped the remote for the camera. You said I had too much headroom.
There you go.
I had to scramble on the floor.
There you go.
To try to find the remote. Day in the life of being a part of a media operation, right? That's what most hosts have to do?
Of course. Of course. That is a classic case of the old drop the remote for the camera play. Yeah, I think you learned that in journalism school, probably.
Yeah.
Folks, thanks for joining us. We'll get right into this. Tomorrow, of course, the House will pass the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. After that, it will move to the Senate. Their plan is to pass it sometime over the next 2 weeks. There is, in mid to late March, a deadline looming, and that is when the bulk of the unemployment insurance extensions and expansions end. And it's going to take a while to get it out the door, so they really need to do this rather quickly. We are all, and by we, I mean the American public in many respects, is waiting on the parliamentarian of the Senate to rule on the question of whether the $15 minimum wage is eligible to be voted upon during reconciliation. We've mentioned this many times before, Emma, but there are specific rules about what, and not just rules, really. I mean, frankly, it's statutory. There are laws as to what can be a part of a reconciliation bill. Reconciliation only requires a simple majority. It does not require a filibuster-proof majority. It can only deal with issues that directly affect the federal budget. We will get into a little bit what the argument is as to why this affects the federal budget. But for now, let's leave it there and start with Wednesday night, last night, Chris Hayes asked Bernie Sanders if there is enough votes in the Senate to pass a $15 minimum wage, considering that there is a filibuster that still exists in the Senate, and you need 60 senators to approve of an increase in the minimum wage. Here's that clip.
Wasn't in this package. Like, do you think you could win a floor vote on it? If you just said up or down.
Oh, no.
No, you couldn't. No, okay.
No, you could not. As of now, there's not one Republican who will support a $15 an hour minimum. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh, I just what you're saying, just to be clear here, is that if you're in a filibuster world and you need 10 Republican votes, you're saying there's not 10 Republican votes to raise the wage.
Let me be very clear about this. The only way that we are going to raise the minimum wage is through reconciliation or ending the filibuster. In my view, I do not see in the foreseeable future getting significant support from Republicans.
So there it is. There's only two ways to get a $15 minimum wage. That is through reconciliation or reconciliation, as the senator says.
I love his peculiar pronunciation of things. There's very few people on this planet who can achieve it.
Yeah, he does it. When he does it, it's charming. I often mispronounce things. It's not so charming.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
But or the Philly Buster, as he didn't call it. In the past, Bernie Sanders has been reluctant to get rid of the filibuster. I suspect that has changed because of the nature of the Republican Party and a nature of the Senate becoming more clear as a non-democratic small D body. We know that the Republicans account for 50 senators, half the Senate, but represent something less than 40% of the population of the country. Because of the nature of the Senate.
And also because he's weighed what needs to happen to make this country an equitable place to live, or just a place to live where you can live. We need a living wage in this country, and he knows that's more important than the filibuster. I mean, I think I disagreed with some of his reasoning in the past on this, one of the few things I disagree with Bernie Sanders on, but he seems to, based on that clip, and based on his softening position on this, have kind of had a switch recently on that.
Now, Ron Klain, the chief of staff for President Biden, says that Joe Biden wants the $15 minimum wage. And we should be clear here. This is a four-year roll-in for the $15 minimum wage. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to roll in. And here is John Thune, Republican. And here is his reasoning as to why a $15 minimum wage is completely absurd. It is unsustainable, according to him, and it is far, presumably far too generous. And he has a story from his own life to show you, all you people who want a living wage, a $15 minimum wage, just how sort of frivolous and spoiled you are.
Anecdotal evidence. That's how all senators should be ruling on important matters like wages.
What's worse is his anecdotal evidence is not supporting the assertion that he thinks it does. Here it is.
Colleagues have pointed out, I think the minimum wage is something that is particularly troubling and harmful at a time when you're trying to get people back to work and trying to create jobs again, because it drives up the cost of hiring people.
One second. And I can let's be clear what's happening right now. People are not going back to work. Businesses are not opening because there's no customers, because there's not enough customers who are willing to go out and buy a sandwich or sit down at a restaurant or whatever it is and risk getting COVID. We have 500,000 people who have died in this country because of this disease in really less than a year. And so the reason why businesses are struggling, it is because there is a pandemic. And in those instances where people are would be willing to go out, which I don't think is as great as John Thune thinks it is irresponsible for governments to allow these places to be open. Now, we should be funding these businesses, make no mistake about it, to keep them afloat. But the real question is, could we sustain a $15 minimum wage? And of course, again, it's not happening overnight. It's not going to happen during COVID. That is why Bernie Sanders, when...
staggered. It goes until 2025. That's when it becomes 15.
When Rand Paul tried to, I think it was, or was it Joni Ernst, tried to offer an amendment saying that we would not raise the minimum wage during COVID, Bernie Sanders said, I'll vote for that because that's not what's happening. So John Thune is setting up a bit of a straw man here. Really, two different straw mans. One is that somehow raising the minimum wage would inhibit demand. It will not. It'll increase demand. You'll get more people in that restaurant. But the problem why we don't have people in the restaurant right now has to do with COVID, has nothing to do with what people are employing, paying their employees. Frankly, the government should be paying the employees. That's a separate story because we would want to discourage people from having to go to work in instances where they might be subjected to getting COVID. But here is the real kicker. John Thune's going to bring his point home. He was a real bootstraps guy back in the day. And you other people, you're all just looking for a handout.
Great jobs again, because it drives up the cost of hiring people. And I can tell you, as somebody like Senator Scott, who was growing up in a small town, I worked for less than the minimum wage. I worked for the minimum wage. I started busing tables at $1 an hour. I went up to 2 1/4 when they moved me up in the place. And then I finally made it to cook, which was big time. That was $6 an hour. But everybody in my town, I grew up in a little town on Interstate 90, as people were heading west to Mount Rushmore and Yellowstone and points beyond, was in one way or another involved in the travel industry. So two of my brothers worked at filling stations. My sister waited tables. My other brother worked at our big local attraction, which was the Pioneer Auto Show. And as I said, I cooked at the Star Family Restaurant. All of those businesses work with very narrow margins. And if you take a $15 minimum wage, and I will tell you right now in South Dakota, the minimum wage, and our state sets it, which is frankly where I think it should be done, our state has a $9.45 minimum wage. What you're essentially telling those businesses in South Dakota that I just mentioned, that you're going to increase the amount of money that they have to pay their workers by over 50%. 50% increase in the wages that they would pay. Well, what does that do? Obviously, it puts a lot of them out of business, but it also raises the cost of everything else. That's got to get passed on. So anybody who's buying a hamburger or filling up or getting a motel room there in that community or communities alike all across South Dakota and all across this country are going to see the cost of doing business go up. That's going to make it that much harder for people who are trying to get back in the economy. And as has already been pointed out, don't believe us. The Congressional Budget Office, which is the scorekeeper, the referee, if you will, when it comes to these issues, has said that it would cost the economy 1.4 million jobs.
Okay. I'm sorry. Just let me jump in really quickly because Johnny Appleseed over here, he's a real picture of American hard work. Yeah. Bussing tables, or maybe he's Johnny Rocket. I don't really know. The reason those jobs would be lost is because the people making a starvation wage right now would no longer have to work three jobs, say at Burger King, say at Walmart, say at McDonald's as well. They would work one job. Primarily the companies that would be affected would be something like McDonald's. It wouldn't be a dollar anymore. It would be $1.50 for a burger off the dollar menu. They may have to adjust their marketing strategy. That would be really difficult. And you may have fewer employees. But the thing about the wage is that it gives, on average, people $4,000 more a year when they're raising it from $7.25, or I guess that was in West Virginia, from $8.50 or whatever it is to $15 over that time. That goes back into the economy and goes back to help those small businesses, as opposed to having to be used on things like utilities, which is what poor people have to do when they are getting their money. Like, it's not able to go back to things like restaurants, which he's trying to paint this all-American picture of right there.
Well, and there have been studies, actually, as to how much the burger would raise. And it's really closer to actually 10 cents, maybe 5 cents. And for folks who have a restaurant, there's a lot of other costs that are associated on top of labor. There is the cost of the food. There is the fixed cost of the location. But let's go to the issue of his saying that he was making $6 an hour back when he was, I think it was in high school. This is before, presumably, still in his hometown. And that would have been some folks. Kevin Cruz, the historian, has done a little bit of research on this. And apparently John Thune would have been at age 16. John Thune, it would have been 1971. And can we put up this this graphic here? So, 1976. John Thune was born in 1961. And that's 1979. It turns out, actually, he would have been 16, but let's just call it 1979. So he would have been 18 in 1979. $6 in 1979, as you can see here, care of the inflation calculator, would be $23.11.
That's incredibly close to the Center for Economic Policy and Research's number, that the minimum wage, if it did keep up with that increase in inflation and with productivity, would be $24 an hour.
If it was the case that John Thune, since we're going by the Thune measure as to whether people deserve a living wage, if it was the case that he was making that money in 1976, $6, this guy's going around, he's making $27 an hour. Almost $28 an hour. No wonder why he was living large back then.
I'm shocked that the restaurant that he cooked food at didn't go out of business immediately, just having to carry John Thune's wage along with him. What a burden he placed on that mom and pop shop.
And let's be clear, who's coming in and eating at that mom and pop shop? Not the people who are making $7 an hour, but if they're making $15 an hour, they're going to go out to eat at that mom and pop shop more likely. And so business is going to increase for everybody. There's been plenty of studies on this. It's conceivable that there is a number that you could raise the minimum wage to, that it would inhibit people's ability to run a business, but there's just no actual data to support that.
There isn't, but they rely on just kind of obscuring those facts and not talking about the issue in a complex way. And people's ignorance. That's a Republican MO.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we will argue, we will talk about what is facing the minimum wage. John Thune is not the biggest obstacle to the minimum wage. In fact, he's not one at all. The biggest obstacle to the minimum wage at this point is whether it will be part of the COVID-19 relief bill. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, one of our sponsors today is Ground News. Ground News is a first-of-its-kind news comparison app. And you can download it totally free by going to ground.news/majority. Look, I've talked about this in the past. Really, one of the things that I think is, like, basically our job here is to have a sense of, like, you know, what reporting is the most credible, and what is what is actually going on. Every outlet has its own, some have more of an agenda than others, but they all have their own perspective. They all have their own assumptions based into it, whether it's a mainstream liberal slanting outlet or a right wing outlet or a British outlet or an American outlet, who finances it, who funds it, who's got better reporters, whatnot. And ultimately, the way that you become a good consumer of media is to read all of these sources and compare. And over time, you start to see patterns. You start to see slants. You start to see, whose reporting holds up over time and whose reporting does not. And that's what's so great about Ground News. It makes it super easy for you to do that. If you have kids and you want to teach them, you know, older kids, I'm not saying like, you know, 7-year-olds, but if you have like teenagers, you want to teach them how to be discerning consumer media, consumers of media and of reporting, an app like Ground News is perfect. It gives you a crystal clear picture of how individual media corporations or outlets or whatever it is are reporting news stories, are spinning them. Maybe you start to realize maybe there's a slight slant here. I wonder why. And you could dig a little bit deeper. But nevertheless, it gives you the opportunity to see across different type of reporting platforms and assess for yourself. Plus, it also raises stories that you may not see because of the nature of the media that you've been consuming. We're all living in our own little bubble. Again, it is ground.news/majority. It's free. Check it out today. Also, one of our sponsors is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp, as you know, gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of people going to therapy for the first time, a lot of people continuing to go to therapy, a lot of people returning to therapy during a pandemic because it's driving everybody a little bit batty. It's very stressful.
Me included.
Everybody. Everybody. And then one of the problems you got is a lot of therapists have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before a therapist can see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist in your first 24 hours. They could tailor it to your specific needs. If there's certain specialties you need from the therapist, BetterHelp has them. They have therapists from all across the country. Those specialties may not be available in your area. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if for whatever reason, it's not the right fit, it happens. Over the years, I've had therapists. And I'm like, you know what? That's not working for me.
Yeah.
You can switch to a new one at any time for no extra cost, for no reason, any reason, I should say, and no additional charge. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they do have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the video description of this program. You can find it in the YouTube, the podcast description, all over the place as we put all of our links are in there. So the big obstacle at this point to the $15 minimum wage in the $1.9 trillion COVID bill, and we should also say the resolution that sets up a reconciliation bill locks in the number 1.9. And so it's always a little bit in flux based upon what's ultimately going to be. That gets locked in before you actually formulate the bill. So it gives you essentially, to use a sports metaphor, like a salary cap. Mm-hmm. And you can expend that on a power forward, or you can spend it on a great new point guard, or you can do some combination of the both, or whatever it is. I'm presuming the NBA has a salary cap.
But yes, maybe they do.
And I got to check with them on that. and so there have been multiple studies about the impact of a $15 minimum wage, and it has ranged from it will provide billions of dollars more to the U.S. Treasury in taxes because you've got people making more money and that money is taxed and it goes into the Treasury and more money is spent, so it could expand the economy, arguably. Certainly, when you give money to people living with low income, they spend that money immediately. It may be on utilities. Maybe it's on food. Maybe it's on, you know what? I'm going to go see a movie because now I'm making a little bit of extra money and I'm going to splurge. I'm going to see a movie once a month or something.
As opposed to the wealthy hoarding it, putting into their investment portfolio, et cetera.
The saying goes, a rich man can only buy one loaf of bread at a time. And when you start getting into millions of dollars, there's just no way to expend that. You put it in the stock market. All you're doing is you're making that money to make more money. You're not actually going out and expending it and putting it into the economy in a way that expands the economy. The question and the Congressional Budget Office ran the numbers on the minimum wage, and they found that it's actually going to increase the deficit. Now, these are based on certain assumptions that people can quibble with. But $64 billion over the course of 10 years is not a huge increase in the deficit. So the number itself is not scaring anybody away in terms of deficit. Of course, there's very little deficit talk anymore. We just passed a tax bill that, put a gaping hole in the deficit. And the fact is that when the economy's hurting, there's a lot of new research and study that show deficits don't seem to have an impact. And if the economy starts to overheat in some fashion, there are certainly ways in which you can slow it down, increase taxes.
And there's also just a lot of repudiation of that CBO report because it's not as bipartisan as people think. It is headed by, I believe, someone with Republican ties.
Oh, yeah. It's a former person from the American Enterprise Institute is heading it, who was appointed by Trump.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, we can quibble back and forth about the accuracy of that report. But regardless of whose report you look at, whether it says it's going to create a deficit or a surplus, the bottom line is that it impacts the federal budget.
Woo-hoo.
On one side of the ledger or another. And as such, Bernie Sanders, many others, believe that it qualifies under the Byrd Rule. However, the Byrd Rule being the rule that says under reconciliation, there's a whole series of laws actually that are associated with it, but the long and short of it is it must impact the U.S. federal budget. However, and so the parliamentarian rules on this says it's okay. You can go forward, and you could, and you can vote on it. It can be included in this budget reconciliation.
And we'll find that out within the next 48 hours. Or
I think we will know this by Monday or Tuesday at the latest. Could be earlier. Here's Congressman Ro Khanna coming on and just reminding people, though. However, that. Not only can the parliamentarian say it can go in, but there is also a rule in the Senate that the vice president of the United States, who is the president of the Senate, essentially, can overrule the parliamentarian's ruling. And here is Ro Khanna on with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC last night.
Lawrence, you started out perfectly. There is no provision in the Constitution that says that the Senate parliamentarian has any power. And Ron Klain is a brilliant constitutional lawyer. He knows that the vice president has this decision. And in 1975, Vice President Rockefeller disregarded the advice of the Senate parliamentarian when they actually lowered the threshold on the filibuster from 67 votes to 60 votes. And Robert Dove, a Senate parliamentarian, who I know you respect because you served in the Senate, has said many times that people have disregarded the parliamentarian's ruling. So we should just be honest with folks. If there are political reasons that the White House doesn't want to disregard the parliamentarian for whatever reason, then just come out and say that. But know that this is the decision that the White House has. The vice president has every power to disregard that decision.
So let's be clear on what's happening here. And Ro Khanna is not the only person who is holding the Biden administration to account. Because as Khanna said Ron Klain is out there saying we would not. And in fact, here is the, you know, Ron Klain had said we would not. Here it is. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain made clear Wednesday in an interview that the administration is opposed to ignoring the advice of the parliamentarian. Quote, certainly that's not something we would do. Now, I don't know how the question was phrased. You can give me advice. I'm not ignoring it. I'm not necessarily going to follow it either. And I may overrule it. But Representative Pramila Jayapal, who is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, appeared on MSNBC also yesterday. That Democrats, quote, made a promise to people across this country that we're going to raise the minimum wage and that we're going to put money in people's pockets. It's been 12 years since we raised the minimum wage. And if we're going to make those promises, we have to be able to deliver on them, Jayapal said. Because I'll tell you what, in 2 years, when people vote in the midterms, you're not going to be able to say, well, I'm sorry, we couldn't raise the minimum wage because the parliamentarian ruled that we couldn't do it. That's not going to fly. And that's not going to fly.
No, but this is what the Biden administration has begun to show is going to be their number one go-to in the playbook. Their best play. If in their minds, I think it's idiotic, but to hide behind procedure, to hide behind these very convoluted Senate procedures or executive action fine print things like with student debt. He's saying, oh, well, it might be legal for me to cancel $10,000 of student debt by executive order, but not $50,000. That's when it becomes illegal. There's nothing that shows that that's the case. It's just he doesn't want to help people that much based on obscure reasons. So he's making up that there's some procedural obstacle in between $10,000 and $50,000, if he does $10,000 at all. And then the same thing here with Klain, who I'm sure this is coming from Biden because it sounds like him. We're not going to overrule the parliamentarian in order to give people $15 minimum wage. We don't know what the parliamentarian is going to rule. Hopefully that we don't even have to cross that bridge. But it is a major obstacle because this could kill $15 minimum wage forever. In the 4 years under Biden, and that would be a huge blow to the Democratic Party because they need to use this opportunity now to materially help people for their own electoral butts, if anything else.
Right, and that's what Bernie Sanders was saying. So you really got two options here: you either do this through reconciliation, or you get rid of the filibuster. And you can leave an unelected parliamentarian in charge of this, or you can simply say that, you know, in this instance, there's just too much evidence that it impacts the budget in one way or another, regardless of whose study you want to look at. There's no studies out there that says it's not going to impact the budget.
These are your values. Last thing, right? Do you value the Senate parliamentarian and the Senate rules and the mythology of the Senate, that the parliamentarian's on the Constitution, but it's just Biden was a senator for many years. He loves just all of the little rules and all of the pieces that make up this body that he was a part of, that he adheres to. Is that what you value, or do you value helping people's lives materially? And if you do value that, you're going to overrule the parliamentarian. But I don't know if he would do that. That kills it immediately. And then you have the other obstacle of Manchin and Sinema.
Well, I find it hard to believe that those two will stand in the way of this as well. But the bottom line is that's why you have Khanna and Jayapal out there, and I imagine there are others, who are saying, come clean. If you don't want a $15 minimum wage, then not have one. But yeah, Don't pretend that it's because of the parliamentarian. Here is a Republican senator, I should say, Roger Marshall. And this is his opportunity to come out with his story about how he pulled up himself by his bootstraps. This is very bootstraps. This is very short. But again, a $15 minimum wage does not keep pace with inflation, does not keep pace with worker productivity. Yet you have all of these Republican senators coming out and comparing apples to oranges. Here is Roger Marshall. Listen to what he has to say about how he worked his way through college.
I worked with about 15 other high school classmates through high school and junior college with a great part-time job, and it was a great supplement to my income and helped me not have any debt when I finished college as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, according to this tweet from Bubba Prague, who is this from, Brendan?
This is Timothy Burke, is his name.
Timothy Burke. Where is he from? Do we know?
He used to work at Deadspin, and now he's got his own media outfit called Burke Comms.
And he makes the point that Roger Marshall's argument for not raising the minimum wage is that he had a minimum wage job and paid for his entire college tuition. When he graduated from Kansas State University, tuition was $898 a year. Not $898,000, not $89,000, not even $8,000 a year. It was under $1,000 a year. Not even $900 a year. It is now $10,000. It is, in other words, more than 10 times more expensive to go to Kansas State University. The minimum wage then was $3.35. And now it is $7.25. Do you see the difference there, right?
Yeah.
One is 10 times less, and the other is just half or double.
All over, yeah.
Yes. I mean, there is a problem with old people like myself that we just sort of assume nothing has changed.
How dare you?
Yes.
You're not old.
I am. I'm not as old as Roger Marshall, but
age
I don't
is a mindset, and Roger Marshall's mindset is...
He's ancient.
It's in... 20 BC.
He's ancient. Meanwhile, so that is what's happening with that. There's one other issue that we should talk about that you should know about in terms of this COVID-19 relief bill. We will see what happens when it comes to the minimum wage. That drama will be playing out over the course of the next 48, 72 hours. There is another issue, and that is... the Democrats have the opportunity to reverse something that they had basically overlooked, which is that unemployment benefits are taxable income. Now, in normal times, this is generally not a problem because there's a smaller portion of the American public that is on unemployment benefits. There is not an expansion of unemployment benefits. There is not such dire circumstances. It's not necessarily something that you would want in normal times, but it's a much bigger problem, both for, as a policy standpoint and certainly politically. Some state and unemployment insurance offices withhold a percentage of unemployment benefits for tax purposes sometimes. And often unemployment benefits are so low that they're not subject to being taxed because you haven't even crossed a threshold where you would actually pay any type of income tax. That is why we saw when there was an expansion, and not just an expansion in terms of like who is eligible, but an increase in the amount of federal subsidy on top of unemployment, and it's going to be $400 in this COVID-19 bill as it stands now. It was $600 back in the early months of following the CARES Act. That pulled a lot of people out of poverty. And so they suddenly became eligible for being taxed. Unlikely that they set aside that money. People were just not aware of this. And so there is a massive hit that people are looking at in terms of being taxed. This is something that Bernie Sanders has called for a long time. That is tax forgiveness on unemployment benefits accrued during the pandemic.
But how would you punish people for taking unemployment benefits, Sam, and make them feel even worse that they're out of work?
Well, it's hard to know if that's sort of the reasoning. I mean,
it is. I mean, it's like so much of politics is about discipline, and that's kind of what it is. It's disciplining you for being out of work in the pandemic. Say you lost your job, say you thought it was going to come back, and then you've been on unemployment for a long time. But somehow you need to personally feel wrong, even though you were the one who was wronged by just a pandemic and a government that didn't respond appropriately.
So there's an opportunity for Democrats here to to essentially write in tax forgiveness for those funds and or to provide tax forgiveness funds. And remember, they're stuck under the $1.9 trillion cap. So if they were to basically say, we are going to waive taxes on unemployment benefits for during the pandemic, it's going to cost the U.S. government something. Now, there are a bunch of moderate, so-called moderate Democrats who are looking, who are a little concerned that they've heard that some governors are going to provide tax cuts based upon the state funding that they get from this bill. So they are looking to earmark some of these money that is set aside for the states and put it into things like infrastructure or put it to something like this that would be $50 billion max, would cover all that, and would keep you under the 1.9 cap. So that is just something to keep an eye on. If there is a late entry to this bill, it can be introduced in the Senate as an amendment to forgive taxes on unemployment benefits. Let's just also briefly now talk about what's going on with the post office.
Oh, yes. This is a fascinating, fascinating story in my view.
Yes. I think people remember that there was a lot of controversy around the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, who was a former basically executive in the overnight delivery business, essentially. And he was appointed Postmaster General by Donald Trump and proceeded to implement plans that many people thought was a way to debilitate the post office as we have a pandemic and a run-up to a lot of increased mail-in voting.
Basically deliberately slowing deliveries by slashing the ability of the post office to process mail on time, their machines, their tech, I believe even their workforce at certain points. This was all as mail-in ballots were surging, and he is continuing to try to cut drastically.
He has a new secret plan.
Right.
In fact, he was on the Hill the other day saying, hey, does it really matter if we delay letters by a day or two? And I mean, literally. And of course, he doesn't care because he's probably gets free FedEx based on his relationships
exactly.
or something.
I mean, but like, again, what is the reasoning? Why slow it down? Like, I wish there was more of a questioning about him in that. Anyway, go
there's
on.
A whole myriad of questions about him. And he was at different times inhibited by court order to impose some of his plans. And so Joe Biden gets into office. He does not have the ability to fire the Postmaster General directly. There is a 9-member board of directors. And there has been a majority of Republicans on that board. There is the chair is a guy named Ron Blum. He was a Trump appointed Democrat. He is the 9th member. And there were 4 Republicans on that board, one other Democrat, and Ron Blum. There was 3 vacancies. And Joe Biden could fire all of them for cause, which wouldn't be that hard to find. But yesterday, Louis DeJoy was in front of a House committee testifying and had this to say. Do we have a clip of this?
Yes.
He's testifying and he's talking to Jim Cooper, representative from Tennessee, Democrat, was being pressed by Jim Cooper, was talking to DeJoy. Here's this clip.
Mr. DeJoy, you're a political appointee, a holdover. No one knows how much longer your board.
That's incorrect. I'm not a political appointee. I was selected by a bipartisan board of governors, and I would really appreciate if you would get that straight.
Well, how much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
As long as the board approves your staying?
Well, that's the as far as my commitment to see our plan through. I'm here until I can see it tangibly produce the results we intended to. I believe the board is committed to that also.
But that's not determined by you. It's determined by the board.
Well, it could be determined by me. I could resign, right? I could get tired of it. I have other things I can do.
The gentleman's time is expired.
That's right. You're riding your Donald Trump. I got other things I could do.
Yeah, I got a stamp collection, you know, in theme with the thing I do with the post office.
At that very moment, the White House was announcing that it had appointed three new people to the board of directors. Yep. President Biden named two Democrats and a nonpartisan voting rights advocate to the to fill three of the four openings on the Postal Service's governing board. This is according to three people briefed on the discussions and later confirmed by the White House, as reported by the Washington Post. Ron Stroman, the Postal Service's recently retired Deputy Postmaster General. Amber McReynolds, the chief executive of the National Vote at Home Institute. I imagine if you support voting by mail, Louis DeJoy is not your favorite Postmaster General. If you probably have a list of,
well,
of your favorite.
Well, I'm sure she's, you know, partial to his lovely personality.
Yeah, exactly. Amber McReynolds, the chief executive of the National Vote at Home Institute. Anton Hajar, the former general counsel of the American Postal Workers Union. If all three win Senate confirmation, the nine-member board would be made up of an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. And then with McReynolds, whose organization is a darling of left-leaning groups, as the lone independent, it is unclear how Ron Blum would vote as to whether he would vote to fire DeJoy. But it's quite clear that the timing of this at least signals that Joe Biden is tired of Louis DeJoy's antics. And I think the American public cares about its postal service.
I think they do, too. I think they don't want a postmaster general who's not interested in mail getting there on time, who arbitrarily says, hey, you know, what does it matter if your mail gets there a few days late, huh?
And we should
also, all the American people care about is my mail coming on time? And then, you know, politics and people clued into politics should care that the ballots are being counted as we move into an era where mail-in ballots may become more frequent.
The Postal Service is really, I mean, just one of the most amazing things about the United States. The breadth and the range of where you can go to get a letter that you are, that if you live completely in the boonies, or if you live in a city surrounded by people, the idea that your mail service is just as takes you just as seriously. And you have the ability to communicate with people around not just the country, but also the world. And also these jobs have become have been for decades a great way of allowing a wide range of people to enter into the middle class. One of the things that's happened apparently at the post office too is that there have been hiring freezes with all management positions. Folks at the post office have been under a tremendous amount of strain and pressure because of this guy. And his interests lie in trying to privatize as much of the mail service as possible. And I got news for you. FedEx is just not going to go to those distant places in any type of reasonable. It's not going to cost you 40 cents to mail a letter. It's going to cost you $15 to go, you know, to the boonies. It's just the bottom line. So hopefully Joe Biden will do this. And what will be interesting, too, is to see what the perspective of these new board of directors are on expanding the services available at the post office. We've talked about this on this program in the past. But we had at one time in this country postal banking.
Yep.
Where basic services, banking services, were provided at the post office. This would help folks who are unhoused. It would help folks who are low income. It would diminish the power of the commercial banks in our society. It makes it would help the post office in terms of their solvency. One of the other things that's going on in the post office, and we have also mentioned this before, back in 2006, there was a bill passed primarily pushed by Republicans, but also joined by Democrats at the time, that required the post office to pre-fund its pension and benefits program by 75 years. You are pre-funding a benefit for people that not only don't work at the post office yet or aren't even born, right? That you're eligible for it at age 65 or after 20, 25 years. You're no entity in the country has that requirement. And it has inhibited, remember, the Postal Service does not rely on government funding. Were it not for these requirements, stamps, deals it makes to deliver Amazon packages, whatever, would pay for the operations of the post office. And there is an attempt to fashion some type of bipartisan response to save the post office. There is some talk that some Democrats are at least being supportive of Louis DeJoy, because if they can get him to sign on to a bill like this.
Well, it's Carolyn Maloney, right?
Maloney, yes.
Maloney, right.
From New York.
Yeah.
So here's a clip from that same hearing. Jim Jordan says that Democrats are hypocrites and the post office is besieged by bipartisanship. Here we go.
Sad.
I mean, you were they had you as the worst guy on the planet back then. And now everything, it seems to be so much better now.
The gentleman's time has expired.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Conley, is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. And all the gaslighting that we just heard does not change facts. Mr. Diamonstein, please move the mic close to your mouth. Thank you. Am I making this up? As Mr. Jordan apparently would have you believe, that the President of the United States last summer, Donald J. Trump, publicly said voting by mail would lead to massive fraud. Did he say that, or am I imagining that, Mr. Diamonstein?
I don't think you're imagining it. What I recall him saying at one point is he was going to make sure that the Postal Service got no financial COVID emergency relief, because then they would be able to effectively deliver ballots.
Thank you. But the point is, it was Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, who was planting the idea, aided and abetted by disruptive changes proposed by a new Postmaster General and a compliant Board of Governors, that actually eroded public confidence in the ability to vote by mail. That wasn't a Democratic narrative. That was a Republican narrative by the President of the United States and his enablers. And oh, by the way, the inconvenient fact, Mr. Heiss would have you believe that it was partisans on this committee, and he quoted a number of Democrats, by the way, admitted Democrats. For the record, I'm an admitted Democrat and damn proud of it. I didn't vote to overturn an election, and I will not be lectured by people who did about partisanship.
Yeah, Jim Jordan doesn't engage in partisanship.
Jim Jordan doesn't also apparently does not respond when some of his players come to him and say, hey, we got a problem with
sexual abuse. Yeah. I mean, it's like the classic conservative projection that we deal with on a daily basis. When Trump politicized the post office, it was not politicized by the previous administration. It was politicized for the exact purpose of Trump trying to lay the groundwork for overturning the election, as Jerry Connolly laid out there. I mean, you can't completely gut it and say, I'm very worried about mail fraud, that's what we're going to see, and make it an entirely political enterprise, or that was the design to do so with his goon, Louis DeJoy, and then say it's the Democrats who are trying to politicize it by doing damage control. It's just that's part of what conservatives do. They always attack and they always they always project.
All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, another disturbing story about Governor Andrew Cuomo. This time has nothing to do with his failures of leadership under COVID. Has to do with just his failure as a person.
Yep.
Period. All right, quick break. We'll be right back. So this story, there had been hints about this story, and I think there had been some reporting on this. Lindsay Boylan, she is a candidate right now for Manhattan Borough President in New York City.
Well, she had basically come out and said that Cuomo sexually harassed her, but she did not really want to go into further details, kind of out of fear, just trying to protect herself initially, and that was some weeks ago.
Yes, and it was, she was an aide to Cuomo, or worked in the state government until 2018. And like you say, she had come out and sort of implied, had sort of talked around the idea that he was abusive in some ways. She wrote an essay on, I guess it was on
Medium,
and pretty disturbing. And I would be surprised if we don't hear from more folks, women in particular, following this. She laid out her experiences over a couple of years with Andrew Cuomo. She didn't work in his office. This was October 2017 at an event in Western New York on his taxpayer-funded jet. They were flying home, and Cuomo says to her, let's play strip poker. And
she also alleges that he kissed her on the lips.
At one point later, or at a different time.
2018.
She says in her essay, Cuomo has created a culture within his administration where sexual harassment and bullying is so pervasive that not only is it condoned, but expected. His inappropriate behavior toward women was an affirmation that he liked you, that you must be doing something right. He used intimidation to silence his critics. If you dared to speak up, you would face consequences. That's why I panicked on the morning of December 13th. That was the morning that he kissed her. But she talks about how different advisors had warned her at various times, be careful around the governor. There's also Ron Kim, the another a New York politician, has come out and said that he was, you know,
bullied.
Bullied.
But this is an open secret in New York that Cuomo is a bully and he's abusive towards people around him, his subordinates. He bullies people to get what he wants. He behaves like a mobster as the governor of New York, much like we see Trump do it more inartfully, and he's not as smart as Cuomo, but we saw him use intimidation tactics in those recorded phone calls with in Georgia with Raffensperger. It's well documented that Cuomo has a history of using bullying and intimidation tactics, and now we also have allegations of sexual harassment and unwanted physical contact.
And there seems to be at least some stuff that she could back up with documentation and evidence. She writes, Stephanie Benton, the directors of the governor's offices, told me in an email on December 14th, 2016, that the governor suggested I look up images of Lisa Shields, his rumored former girlfriend, because, and she quotes here, we could be sisters, and I was, quote, the better-looking sister. That, to me, sounds like she still has that email. The governor began calling me Lisa in front of colleagues. It was degrading. That is creepy.
Yep. And also just degrading is a good word to put in front of it or to describe it, because it also dehumanizes her and makes her, as a woman, an employee, an important, smart, presumably person working for the state, only a function of him, basically, because she looks like his ex-girlfriend, so it has creepy to be a part of him.
She writes, I had complained to friends that the governor would go out of his way to touch me on my lower back and arms and legs. Now, the I complained to friends is her saying that I have what is known as contemporaneous reports at that time. When people look at these type of accusations, they see at the time, did the accuser tell anybody else about this? So she is laying out what is a very clear case. And
this shouldn't be shocking based on what we know about Andrew Cuomo, is all I'll say as well.
Yep. And she writes that she had left. And the reason why that she started to speak up, and other people did too, is because it was rumored that he was perhaps up for the attorney general's position in the Biden administration. I don't know how Cuomo skirts past this one. I mean, he's wriggled out of a lot of things in New York State, but we'll see if he does this one. We will talk more on a follow up on this tomorrow. And until then, don't forget, if you missed any part of this show, 5 p.m., 10 p.m. on the Peacock app, look up on Choice Channel or just search for The Majority Report. We'll see you tomorrow. And for the rest of you, we'll see you today. I'm going to move into the fun half. I am going to step away from the desk slowly with my hands in the air. And Emma and
put your hands up.
Oh, Matt. Oh, and Jamie will be here. And Brendan, of course. New Matt is on vacation. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We get 94.3% of our funding comes from members at this point. I mean, I haven't done the actual numbers, but it's pretty close to that. So if you can support this program, you support the free show, you get the fun half, jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget amquickie.com. If you want 7 minutes of headline news in the morning, and also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check out the Nomi Key Show, youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show, or twitch.tv/the Nomi Key Show. Old Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
Hello, Sam. Well, turns out that if you were just listening to The Majority Report and enjoyed hearing people talk about Cuomo in a critical way, then tonight's Doomed will be a show for you, because at youtube.com/Matt Binder, live tonight at 9 p.m., New York Assemblyman Ron Kim is joining me on the show to talk about what he's been going through with Andrew Cuomo and his fight to basically show what's been going on inside of New York City's nursing homes during the COVID pandemic, and basically what Cuomo has been doing to him to try to get him to try to silence him pretty much. He'll be on the show to talk about Cuomo, COVID, the anti-Asian racist attacks that have been going on in this country for the past year. All that tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder with New York Assemblyman Ron Kim.
That's awesome. Good get.
Good job.
Thank you.
Matt Binder. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Hello. Well, this week on the Antifada, we had on our friends Moog and Matt from the Woodbine Space, which is a radical community center in Ridgewood, Queens, for a little chat about the new Adam Curtis series on the BBC. We put out the first part of it on Wednesday, yesterday. There's going to be a bonus coming out tomorrow, Friday. We all took kind of different views of it. I played the skeptic, because I was having a tanky day and I was like, you know what, this guy's an anti-communist, but I straddle the line between tendencies. So I was equally angry on behalf of the Bolsheviks, the Chinese, and May 68, because, you know, it takes all kinds at the Antifada. But I think it was a very good conversation. And that's out now, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, we have our Twitch stream 4 nights a week at 7. Tonight, I'm doing my second Antifada Ladies Night with Kate Willett, very funny lady. She wrote an audiobook about men and what's up with them. So we're going to talk about that. Yeah, check it out. twitch.tv/theantifada.
Great. And also check out Left Reckoning. I'm not sure what Matt's got up. Usually they go on Thursdays, but who knows?
I mean, is he? Yeah, what is he on vacation or is he doing Left Reckoning?
Oh, is Matt's not. Lex not here. What's going on?
He's on vacation.
Matt,
oh, I don't know. Who knows? I don't know this stuff.
Found yourself as top Matt today.
You're going Matt solo today.
Oh wow!
All right, classic.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. These guys will see you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner to the song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.